They've played a huge role in the struggles in Wisconsin. There's another group, American Federation for Children, which is funded, led by Betty DeVos, a former chair of the Republican Party of Michigan, and sister of Eric Prince, the leader of the XE, the mercenary outfit formerly known as Blackwater. She's married to the billionaire Amway founder, Richard DeVos, and so they have poured huge amounts of money into elections, into what we call AstroTurf community organizations, to promote privatization of our schools. And there's a whole host of other foundations, the Walmart Foundation, the Walton Family Foundation, Chase Foundation, the Bradley Foundation in Milwaukee, which was a longtime supporter of private schools. They provided the financial support of the Bell Curve, which you might remember posits that African Americans as a group are genetically less intelligent.
Right. Bob, tell us about their claims. You know, they appeal to the public, make a number of claims that schools are broken and that teachers' unions really are the villain in this whole story.
Right. Well, you know, what's interesting is it's a broader international phenomenon, of course. It's, you know, people criticize the public sector. They defund the public sector, which makes the public sector weaker. And certainly the public sector, like any democratic institution, has some weaknesses. The question is, are we going to abandon it or are we going to fix it? But so their claim is essentially that the public sector, or what they sometimes they call government schools, don't work. They have weaknesses. And as I say, it's important for us who defend public schools to admit that there are weaknesses and fix them. No institution is perfect. And certainly in institutions that's growing up in the context of American society have racial and gender and class biases. We have to overcome those. That being said, the most popular and their most convincing argument is that people should have choice. And you know, it's sort of hard to be against choice. I mean, everybody wants to choose different things. And on a certain level, I think there should be choice within classrooms, within schools, within public school systems, so that people's and children's interests and strengths are really built upon. However, choice in this day and age has become a code word for privatization and corporatization of our schools. By the promoting of individual choice and consumeristic choice in this society around schools, what we are doing is defunding and destroying the collective choice of public schools. Public schools, which in every state constitution is a guaranteed right, and that's the real danger.
Let's talk about choice. Choice, of course, is what people have, let's say, in nursing home systems or in care for the elderly. They have a great deal of choice. And, of course, they have real good choices if they have a lot of money.
That's right.
If they don't have money, they get, in nursing homes, it's early death. But in schools, if you don't have a lot of money and the vouchers don't pay much, what you get are, at best, holding institutions.
Right. And what we get in Wisconsin and Milwaukee in particular, is the fact that these schools don't service the more hard-to-educate children. So, for instance, in the 112 voucher schools that serve 25,000 students in the Milwaukee area, there's only literally a handful of special needs students. There's more special needs students in a Hamilton High School, a comprehensive Milwaukee public high school, than all 112 schools in the voucher program in Milwaukee. And similarly, Milwaukee happened to have been the first city in the nation where the city government could charter privately run schools. And in those schools as well, even though there's a modicum of more public oversight with the charter schools, they serve a third as many English language students, English language learners, and half as many special needs students as the public schools.
Right. You know, Bob, what I find remarkable, though, is that on these sort of national surveys using testing, in fact, high-stakes testing generally, what they find is that, you know, the Stanford studies and the
right.
Lubienski recent study, the most remarkable thing that, in fact, public school students, that is match for an economic class, they do as well or better than the charters and the private schools. It's quite, it's a finding which is sort of both amazing and, in fact, many ways wonderful.
Right, because those private and charter schools that you mentioned are very selective schools, ultimately. They select out sometimes right at the beginning, well, we can't service your child, or if the kid misbehaves or they have low grades, they're counseled out. And, of course, they come back to the public schools because the public schools.
But still, the public schools, even for those kids,
right?
and for our kids with a large number with real problems and real problems in schools, the public schools seem to do just as well as the, and in some cases better than the privates and the charters.
That is absolutely the case.
And the reason is, I think, the Lubienski study, they went into it, is that public school teachers are better trained, they're there longer, they're more interested, they work together better, and they have much lower turnovers because they're paid better and they make it a career. It seems to me the case that the private school people make and the charter school people make is really bogus and deeply deceptive.
Right. I think a couple of things there. I mean, one is the charter school movement, if we want to call it that, actually was started with a sort of progressive bent, that they wanted to do experimentation when there was a certain level of regulation and bureaucracy that prevented that, and so on and so forth. The fact of the matter is the charter school movement has been hijacked by folks with a corporate agenda. And so while there are some, I don't say I'm opposed to all charter schools. My attitude is if the public charter school where people are able to join unions and there's democratic control of who's, you know, runs those schools, then that's in the ballpark. Otherwise, the McFranchise charter schools that are getting millions and millions of dollars from not only foundations, but from our own Department of Education on a federal level, are those which I think are fundamentally opposed to the democratic institution of public education. And quite frankly, the Obama administration should be ashamed of itself for such a promotion of that kind of privatized agenda.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Bob Peterson. We've been discussing the movement from above of elites, and in fact, as Diane Ravitch calls them, the boy billionaires who sort of lead it, a very large number of them crusading to destroy public education. But they aren't succeeding, Bob. They're succeeding to some extent in Milwaukee to a large extent, but they aren't succeeding across the nation. And in fact, they lost when they used to run voucher initiatives, for example, in California. They lost because parents actually, even though they're convinced the schools are broken by all that propaganda, that's all they ever hear, they're convinced that their kids are going to a good school, that their teachers care, that their kids are learning.
There's never been a popular vote in favor of school privatization and voucher schools. And it's been put to referendum in several states over time, and school vouchers are always voted down. Now, unfortunately, school voucher programs have increased because corporate bought-off legislators and Tea Party advocates and so on and so forth have control certain state legislatures, and they've promoted that way. What's interesting is, in Wisconsin, I think this is typical, the Bain argument 25 years ago was, well, we have too much government regulation, we have school district bureaucracy, and we have those horrible teacher unions with this horrible teacher contract. So for 25 years, the voucher schools in Milwaukee, which basically constitute the third largest school district in the state, have not had any government bureaucracy or state regulation or teacher unions or contracts, and yet they have nothing to show for it. As you say, even without the special needs kids, they can't do better than the public schools by the sole marker of, you know, test scores, which has its own set of issues. And so their claims are really bogus.
Their claims are bogus, and saying that is useful and pointing it out. It's just amazing, actually, that can't do better when they're able to kick out all of the poor scoring kids. I mean, but it seems to me that still the struggle for schools is the same one that was when they were running voucher systems. It basically ultimately depends on whether the public schools have parent support. In Portland, the Portland teachers achieved really a remarkable, decent contract, not much more money, but a lot more control of the schools, actually. I mean, the possibilities, at least, of offering really interesting curriculum, stimulating, engaging curriculum that kids really like. And there's nothing more heartwarming for a parent than when a kid comes home with books and wants to read and wants to talk about ideas. They love the schools when that happens. It seems to me that the struggle for public education depends on teachers really doing well in their schools, collaborating together and building good curriculums, which is where Rethinking Schools comes in, because you've modeled so many good curriculums. Is that hypothesis right? And what can teachers do now?
Absolutely right. I mean, I think teachers working with parents and community leaders and students need to really project the notion that schools should be greenhouses of democracy and of social justice. They should work to revitalize the neighborhoods they're in and to make sure that the schools are democratic institutions. Part of that, quite frankly, starts with making sure you have a democratically elected school board. You know, one of Arne Duncan's quests ever since he was appointed Secretary of Education was to bring more and more schools under mayoral control or corporate control and get rid of the publicly elected school boards. He tried to do that in Milwaukee. In fact, despite our defeats around vouchers and so on and so forth, we beat back that attempt that was actually led by the Democratic governor and Democratic mayor of Milwaukee in 2009 and early parts of 2010. We're the largest urban area ever to defeat that. And we did that because especially the African-American community saw it as an extension of voter suppression laws. Basically, you take away people's individual right to vote, but you also take away the right to have democratically elected councils, you know, to run the school, whether it's a school board or an entire, you know, or an individual school. We have to make sure we defend that. And I know in Chicago, for example, there's a movement underway to reclaim the school board and promote some democracy instead of having it basically run by millionaires and bankers and corporate leaders through an appointed system. So that's one thing. I think in our classrooms, though, we also have to understand that it's our responsibility as teachers to get kids to think about what's going on in their lives. In fact, it's not only our responsibility, it's one of the best ways to motivate kids. We know that 90% of learning is having kids motivated and wanting to learn whatever subject we're trying to teach them. And by connecting things to their lives, to conflicts in the community and controversy, both in the local neighborhood all the way through distant lands where there might be wars or climate crises or so on and so forth, that's the way to motivate children, you know. And so I think the notion that we must see as our responsibility as teachers the education of not only kids for careers in college, which is what everybody likes to say, but also to be citizens, to be active, critical citizens who can think and act. And so how do you do that? We know teachers have to model that. The best way to teach something is to model it, and that's to be active oneself. Now, I know it's easy for us to say that. Teachers at this point are so overwhelmed with testing and data input and all these regulations, it's hard, but I don't see any other way forward for a progressive teacher than to say, no matter what, I'm going to interject these kind of notions into my classroom and bring my classroom alive.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Radio 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon, talking to Bob Peterson, a 30-year classroom teacher and now president of the Milwaukee Teachers Union. And he's also the founding editor for the last, 28 years of the journal Rethinking Schools. Give us some samples, some real, you know, concrete examples of how you get kids motivated by, in fact, studying their histories, studying their neighborhoods. Give us some concrete examples.
Yeah, well, as a fifth grade teacher, I've done a number of things. I mean, one is the children always do in my room an autobiography, but it's an autobiography that tries to connect them to their past, but also where they live in the neighborhood, describe their neighborhood, and you know, interview their parents, interview relatives, and learn from each other about their connections to the community and so on and so forth. That's just sort of common sense that one would do that. Every week we have a new song of the week, and the songs vary from, you know, from folk songs to popular rock songs to whatever songs that talk about labor history, Native American history, social issues that are of the day. And that really brings a lot of discussion to the classroom. Every year, my fifth grade students put Christopher Columbus on trial for genocide. And some people say, oh, it's way too biased or something. It's not. I mean, we're trying to get kids to understand that in an important historical period like that, like the first time that Europeans and Native Americans encountered each other, that there are various different points of view. And so there's a king and queen and their lawyers, Columbus and lawyers, the crew and their lawyers, the Taínos.
Oh, you did it as a role play.
You did it as a role play. They break into groups and they study their roles. They develop critique. They understand, have to understand what happened back then. Obviously, there's a lot of background information and dialogue that we have. And then the kids have a trial. So it's role play. The other thing is in literature class, I have children read books that have characters who are involved in a variety of things and raise issues of social justice. Historical fiction around the abolitionist movement and labor struggles, contemporary realistic fiction that raise issues like as simple as like the story Maniac McGee, where issues of race and homelessness. Just my classroom is filled with daily discussion of issues of race and gender issues. I mean, and, but it's not like I'm brainwashing the kids. It's like we're just, this is part of life. And kids become alive on it. In math class, for example, and I might replace a traditional story problem that will be about kids going to store to buy candy bars, you know, you're doing multiplication problems, you know, double-digit multiplication, with a problem of my own that has to do with how much money young children the same age of my students are making in a factory in Honduras producing Walmart clothing. The same skill can be taught, the multiplication skill, but in a different context.
Bob, I went to school in Milwaukee, but not with a teacher like Bob Peterson, unfortunately. It took me a long time before I began really reading and thinking. In fact, it was after college, believe it or not. Bob Peterson, the parents of your kids, the kids that you taught, they must have been overwhelmingly appreciative of you getting the kids interested in reading and writing and thinking. So congratulations on that. I hope you do well as the president of the Milwaukee Teachers Union. It was really good talking to you.
It's been my pleasure, and I encourage teachers to do the same and check out Rethinking Schools, the website, to get a lot of more information.
Thank you, Bob.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Hi, folks. That was Allie Wesley, a local singer. Her song, Blah Blah, with that insistent ringing. I hope not in her ears continuously. It was from her independently produced album, All Things My Two Fishes. Before that, Bob Peterson of Rethinking Schools on how to save public education from the corporatizers and create the schools Portland children deserve. Coming up on The Old Mole, Joe Clement talks to Anna Coote about reducing the work week to 30 hours. Later, Mole Jan Hocken talks with author Diane Garris Gardner about asylums in Oregon and what's changed, what stayed the same, and the range of people confined behind the walls. Today's music will be on Women and Madness. Next on The Mole, Joe Clement and Anna Coote, reducing the work week, why that's a great idea for so many reasons.
Well, good morning. I am Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I am joined by Anna Coot of the New Economics Foundation. She's the head of social policy there. She wrote an article for the New York Times somewhat recently making the case for a pretty dramatic reduction in the overall work time that people put in every week from whatever it is to 30 hours. Thank you for joining us, Anna.
That's a pleasure.
So you wrote this article for the New York Times, but this is not just an idea that you came up with for that article. It's actually been a kind of long-term project of your organization. Could you tell us a bit about New Economics Foundation and the book that is attached to this article that I think more thoroughly goes over your arguments called Time on Our Side?
Yeah, sure. Well, the New Economics Foundation is a think tank based in London, and uniquely we look at society, economy, and environment. So we look at the way that they connect together and how they affect people's lives and the future of the planet and the state of the economy. So that's what we do. And I'm responsible for the social policy element of that, but all of my work on social policy connects with economic policy and environmental policy. And so we came to think of the whole business of time, not just the shorter working week, but how we value our time and how we distribute paid and unpaid time, who has more of it, who has less of it, and so on. And we've been working on this since about 2009. Most recently, we've brought out this book called Time on Our Side, which brings together a number of different experts from different disciplines talking about the case for a shorter working week, and particularly using as a way of opening the discussion, let's have a 30-hour week instead of a 40-hour week or a 50-hour week.
Where do those numbers come from? Because I notice, you know, you make the case for a 30-hour week in your New York Times article, though in earlier publications through NEF and the Time on Our Side book itself, you make the argument for even shorter hours, 21 hours a week.
Well, the first thing that we brought out was called 21 hours, and we wanted to make a provocation. I think the point we were trying to make there was, don't let's just tinker around the edges. We need to do something radical here. So we want to have quite a distinctive break from the work patterns that we have now to something new. But when a couple of years later, after we talked to other experts and so on, we decided to make our main proposal for a 30-hour week because it's more accessible and more people can relate to it more easily, and it's nearer to things that people can imagine for themselves. So what we say now really is, you know, we want to make part-time the new full-time. So if a part-time job lasts for 30 hours and we call it part-time and we treat it in a particular way as something that is of a lower status and probably attracting lower pay because it's a part-time job, well, that should be the way we think about all work, that it should all be the equivalent of part-time hours.
What I like about that is, you know, having a smaller unit of kind of expected social contribution allows people to manage their time, I think, in more fulfilling or more holistic ways where your life isn't defined by doing something 40 or more hours a week.
Yes, we've got into this extraordinary habit, really, of thinking the only way in which we can be recognized as doing something valuable is by doing paid work. And the more paid work we do, apparently, the more valuable we are to society. And that completely overlooks all the unpaid work and unpaid activities that we do that are just as valuable, starting with looking after our children and caring for our elderly relatives and the creative work we do and the time we spend with friends and the time that we should be spending finding out about what's going on in our communities, for example, and taking part in political activities. You cannot have a vibrant democracy unless people have got time to participate. So we need our time for a range of other things, and we've simply sold too much of our time to working life, and we need to reclaim it and value the things that we do that aren't paid, that don't count as paid jobs.
One of the elements that you draw out in your shorter article has to do with the ecological impact of reduced work time and the amount of time that we on average put in now. And one of the take-home points, I think, that you offer is that because we are so overworked, because we, you know, barely have enough time to go from work to sleep without all the other things that we still have expected of us, we tend towards convenience items, or we tend towards, you know, things that make us feel good, that in the short term, you know, give us a boost and really probably aren't good for our health, and we wonder why we're buying them at the end of the day. And, you know, one of those elements, which is a little, I think, broader in its vision, has to do with transit and the sustainability of how we, you know, go about things in a slower way. We accept more time being put into how things need to be processed so that they aren't made more efficient through chemicals and things like that.
Yes, well, I mean, there's lots of angles here. One is on traveling. If you want to get from A to B and you're working very long hours, you're going to be much busier, so you're probably going to take the car instead of going on bike or by foot, or you're going to take a plane instead of a train, so you take much less sustainable transport. And the contrast between air travel and train travel is really phenomenal. You have a much, much bigger carbon footprint if you're traveling by plane a lot. So that's one thing. And then you have to think about the way in which you, people who are busy, and it's kind of high status these days to be busy. So it's good to be busy, and we feel good about ourselves if we can tell everybody that we're very busy. And if we're very busy, we haven't got time to prepare food and cook it. So we go and we buy energy-intensive processed foods, ready meals and things that probably aren't very good for our health and are much more take a much bigger toll on the natural environment. And we chuck things out instead of repairing them, and we buy things instead of making them. And so if we were to kind of get out of the fast lane of life and live life at a different pace, we would probably enjoy it more, and we'd certainly live a more sustainable life. So more time gives you more of a chance to live more sustainably in a way that's kinder to the natural environment.
Yeah, I like the way that that somewhat demoralizes the issue, because it's very easy to just, you know, get angry at consumers, you know, the especially the typical American image of the person who will kill somebody to get into Walmart on the opening day that some product is being released. That it, by recognizing that people have real reasons for being inclined to do these things, it, I think, also, it makes it more inviting to, you know, ask how could we live life differently, even if we immediately don't feel like, maybe this isn't good for me. It's much more inviting.
Yes. We also have to think about why we work. Now, there are a lot of people who work long hours because they can only survive that way. If they work long hours, they can only keep a roof over their head and look after themselves and their families and put food on the table by working long hours. I would say that's a problem of low pay, which we ought to address directly. So the what you get for an hour's work is not enough, and we need to address the problem of low pay in order to tackle that. When you get beyond that point, earning more money, working long hours to earn more money, means you can buy more stuff. And, of course, the way that the economy is arranged at the moment depends on people going out and spending money. The more we spend, the more the economy apparently grows. But, of course, then the worse it is for the natural environment. So this is also a call to people to say, how much is enough? How much do you really need? Do you really need to work those extra hours in order to buy that, to earn that money, to buy those things that themselves will end up ruining the planet? Because a lot of the things we buy, we don't need. And also, there's plenty of hard evidence that above a certain level, earning more money and having more stuff doesn't make you any happier. It doesn't increase your well-being. And another interesting thing I discovered the other day is that what's the one of the largest, fastest-growing businesses, certainly in the UK, and I bet in the United States as well, it's self-storage, personal self-storage. And that's because people are buying more things than they can fit into their houses. They have to go out and rent extra space to put the stuff in. Well, that's crazy.
Yeah, a very popular American comedian, George Carlin, had a very well-known skit about stuff in which he specifically skewers this American predilection for stuff and having so much stuff that we even have to rent out other places we don't use for anything else but our stuff.
We want to question how much we need and how much is enough, not just because it's kind of good for us, but because it's essential if we're going to avoid catastrophic levels of global warming and catastrophic climate change and depletion of natural resources. we must preserve the planet for future generations, so we must cut down on our consumption anyway.
Yeah, I don't know what the housing situation is like in the UK, but I know in the United States, housing is, I think, a major reason why people are willing to submit to long hours. And, you know, some Marxist conspiracists might even say that the propagandizing of the American middle class to buy into home ownership in the middle 20th century was a way of, you know, making them much more exploitable, much more willing to do what it took to keep the job that's going to pay for the house. And it's not just kind of disposable crud that we spend our money on, but, you know, the need to have money is also built into our more foundational things that we need in life.
Well, yes, I mean, certainly in London, house prices are rising at a phenomenal rate, and an awful lot of people can't afford to buy their own homes, and people do want to buy their own homes because we've all got used to the idea that we should be homeowners now. Although many quite prosperous countries in Europe, for example, get by very well with people renting instead of buying. But rents are high as well. Now, this doesn't have to be the case. Government can regulate rents, can make sure that more homes are built, can make sure that landlords don't exploit their tenants, can make sure that there aren't too many empty properties. There's an awful lot of empty property in London that's been brought up by people who don't live in London just as an investment. So there's all this empty property, and then people haven't got homes. Now, that's a matter of public policy. It should be addressed through public policy in order that people can get homes that they can afford. So you can't just say, well, everybody's got to keep on working so that they can afford to buy their own homes. It's like the problem of low pay. You need to tackle the problem of expensive housing through another channel, through government action and regulation of the housing market.
I want to turn back to the New York Times article and address this issue or go back to this question of low pay. I really liked how you said some say it can't be done because wages are too low, so let's raise wages. No one should have to work long hours just to get by. And again, the situation may be different in London and in Europe in general, where there's been a much more productive relationship between society and its government than in the United States, where government has been much more forcefully the protector and the interest server of business and of interests that want to keep America, want to keep it that way. And I'm wondering what lessons we may have to draw from earlier 20th century struggles over these same issues. I mean, the call for shorter hours comes from the labor movement, not from economists working for the government thinking it would be good for the economy. So how
That's
do we...
quite right. There's a difficult lesson there because, of course, all the gains that were made, bringing down the length of the working week, the statutory length of the working week, were made through, as you say, the struggle of trade unions representing the labor force in different ways. And we've kind of lost the strength of the trade unions over the last 30 years or so. And that's something that we've got to find a way of coping with, because either we rebuild the capacity of working people to get together and fight for a better deal, or we've got to go through government to ensure that they have a decent level of a minimum wage or what we call a fair living wage that employers are compelled to pay to their workers. I think you probably need both. You need to find ways of enlivening and increasing the capacity of working people who, of course, work in a very different set of circumstances than they did 30 years ago. But we've got to find a way of workers standing up for themselves, because they don't now. Because we've been told for so long that we're just individuals and we just have to look after ourselves, and we don't need to stand to look after one another. We just have to look out for ourselves and our families. That's, if you like to coin a phrase, the dominant narrative. That's what we've been told. But, of course, all the things that workers have gained in the past that have made life livable, you know, like paid holidays and weekends and a reasonable length of the working week, that's all been done through the labor unions.
Well, that is all the time I think we have for today. Thank you, Anna Coot, for joining us today to talk about why we need to reduce the work week. Her article appears in the New York Times, and we'll provide a link to that when this is posted online.
Thank you.
Thanks, Joe Clement and Anna Coot. This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon, your Old Mobile Variety Hour. The Old Mole explores the near countless struggles from below that one fine day will unite in a vast movement to reconstruct this country and ultimately the world. That's, of course, our great hope, or the age of Homo sapiens will come to a very inglorious end, painful and miserable end. But it can't be avoided. Listen to KBOO Radio and the Old Mole. Coming up today on the Mole at 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia with cutting-edge news, views, and just plain horse sense with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Locus Focus, host Barbara Bernstein, guest is Michelle Nyhaus. They'll be talking on Can Coal Ever Be Clean? At 11, Disability Awareness, host Grace Eagle Reed, a monthly show about issues affecting people with disabilities and their communities. And at 11:30, it's Health and Healthcare Forum with host Roberta Hall. Today's guest is child therapist Peter Goodman. Today, it's the conclusion of a two-part series on the emotional needs that all children have in growing up in an increasingly stressful society. And some good news, today's high temperature near 71 and sunny.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh, Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood. Sometimes, baby, I'm so carefree with a joy that's hard to hide. And then sometimes again it seems that all I have is worry. And then you're bound to see.
That was Nina Simone with Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood. This is Jan Hawken talking today with Oregon author Diane Garris Gardner about her new book, Inside Oregon State Hospital, A History of Tragedy and Triumph. Welcome to KBOO, Diane Garris Gardner.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Well, Nina Simone's song, Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood, is in part the history of madness, which is itself greatly misunderstood. You have several previous books on Oregon social history, Necktie Parties, A History of Legal Executions in Oregon, 1851 to 1905, and Murder, Morality, and Madness, Women Criminals in Early Oregon. Both books focused on crime and madness. And in taking up the topic of the Oregon State Hospital, you're also, in a sense, looking at this boundary between crime and madness, including in women's history, uncovering or recovering this part of the state's past. Tell us about the book and some of the main ideas behind this excavation of our state's past.
Well, when I heard that they were going to be remodeling the state hospital, I felt that it was time that we had a full history, especially before many of the buildings were destroyed. And so I started doing the research on it about 2008, and then the book was released this past year. But I was really compelled to start doing the research when I read a statistic that approximately one out of every third person is going to be affected by mental health issues, either in their past or in their future, and that could be mental illness could affect them personally, or mental illness could affect someone in their family, or someone with mental illness could impact their life adversely. And it seemed to me that we as a citizen in our state and our community, we need to be aware and participate in making sure that we know what's going on in the mental health field.
So the history of the hospital is a history, in a sense, of mental illness, although the concept of mental illness or mental diseases itself itself continues to be contested, whether the medical model is the best model for understanding the troubles people have with states of mind. But most people who suffer some kind of mental condition diagnosed as a mental disorder don't end up in the state hospital. What were you trying to say about the people's lives who end up at the hospital? And perhaps it would be good to start with the case of Charity Lamb, who was one of the first, certainly I think the first woman admitted to the state hospital in 1862.
Well, Charity's case is particularly interesting, number one, because she was convicted of murdering her husband, and she was a severely abused woman, and the all-male jury couldn't understand why she killed her husband. And so they convicted her of second-degree murder, and at that time, Oregon didn't even have a prison. And eventually, she was put in the new prison in Portland for a while, but the governor decided he didn't like having a woman in prison, and so he transferred her to the only mental health facility in Oregon at that time, which was the Hawthorne Asylum in Portland.
And named after Dr. Yes, Hawthorne.
Dr. J.C. Uh-huh. Hawthorne. And we still have that name in Portland, the Hawthorne Bridge, Hawthorne District, and that all comes from where the Hawthorne asylum was located on the west side, the east side of the river. But at that time, therapy consisted of a very common sense kind of therapy. It was called moral therapy, it consisted of good food, fresh air, a relief from a person's worries, mild exercise, some kind of productive labor, and
that philosophy was certainly an advance over the shackle treatment of the previous centuries.
The previous century had been a ruin, basically, as far as mental illness was concerned, when they believed that devils inhabited people and so forth. And Oregon's history started out with the Hawthorne Asylum, and that kind of treatment was carried over to the Oregon State Hospital when it was built in Salem. And at that time, it was called the Oregon State Insane Asylum. And it wasn't until 1913 that the name was changed to the Oregon State Hospital. And that really represented a change from this kind of, kind of calming, getting morally reestablished in your life to a hospital setting, treating mental illness as a disease.
Your example of Charity Lamb, who kills her husband quite brutally, you describe the scene of her of her killing him with an axe from behind in response to the threat of his taking her children away. And so it was in many ways a sympathetic case she represented, but it also seemed to register what you describe as this discomfort with a woman being in the penitentiary, and this history of men being more apt to be cast, men with mental disorders being cast as bad and women as mad, women more often cast as requiring the protection and guidance of the state rather than punitive treatment. And here I think feminist scholars of madness have been quite ambivalent about the role of the asylum in our collective history, whether it's a place of sanctuary. You certainly describe the hospital as much more of a place of sanctuary than the prisons and the penitentiary. How do you try to cast those two sides of this, of the history of the state asylum?
Well, I think the history of the Oregon State Hospital is one of constant ambivalence between, is it a hospital or is it a prison?
And, because in a sense, it's both.
Because in a sense, it is both. And the hospital administration really establishes which side of that ambivalence that the hospital is going to exhibit at that time. And especially in the last, 40, 50 years, as each superintendent was in charge of the hospital, I think the way that the hospital responded to that issue is very apparent. And so it becomes extremely important to know how the current or prospective superintendent feels on that subject, because it determines very much how the patients are going to be treated in many ways.
Isn't the superintendent also responding to the broader climate around crime and incarceration? You described the recent era of escapes and the controversies and public panics over escapes from the hospital that lead to more restrictive policies and more prison-like setting.
Yeah, I didn't mean to indicate that was the only thing that determines it. I think, like you say, it's very much determined by who has escaped, what they've done on an escape, what the current philosophy is on rehabilitation versus punishment. You know, there's a lot of other kind of factors that come into it. But there's, and also what the political climate is, and because it's, how much money the hospital gets and what they can do with it. And so there's a lot of other aspects. And that's where, we as citizens can actually have a big influence on what our legislatures vote for or vote against.
Another part of that political history you cover in the book that is, I think, readily repressed collectively is the history of the eugenics movement and how the hospital became a site for forced sterilizations around that very virulently racist movement and period. Can you say a little about that?
Well, it began about 1914, and in 2002, Governor Kitzhaber, who was also governor at that time, made a public apology to over 2,000 Oregon citizens that had been sterilized, in some cases against their will, or not understanding why they were being sterilized, in a repressive movement called the eugenics movement, that the main philosophy was the kind of killing off of all the bad people, and the people that were determining who was bad were the men who were in charge of our state institutions.
Yeah.
The state hospital, the Fairview, all those main institutions.
This is one of those stories of tragedy alongside the progressive currents of the history of the hospital. Well, thanks so much for being with us today, Diane. This is Jan Hawkins speaking today with Diane Garris-Gardner, author of Inside Oregon State Hospital, A History of Tragedy and Triumph. Buy this and other books by Garris-Gardner on her website or on other sites online. And you'll also have links to her books on our website on KBOO. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, Lord, I'd be lost, but for the grace of God.
but it seems so poor. Cause no one comes to call on him, and his phone, it never rings. He wanders through his empty home, surrounded by his things. Silently I say a little prayer. Yes, I do.
Well, that's another music about madness, but for the grace of God. And as Diane Garris Gardner was suggesting, but for the grace of God, we all may end up in a state hospital. There are different ways of understanding the idea that we are all in some ways potentially affected by madness or diagnosed, or when lives fall apart, end up in a state hospital. So the conditions of life behind those walls relate to all of us in an important way. And in a sense, the history of the hospital is as much about the history of misfits, people who don't fit in, who are caught in the repressive grid of normalcy that prevails, and different categories and different periods of time in history define madness or mental illness differently. So there's always the potential for stepping over a line and falling into the both protective and punitive arms of state psychiatric asylums. Bill, did you want to finish up today about women in madness? That was part one theme in Garris Gardner's book was women's history.
Yes, I was hoping that you would, in fact, finish up on women in madness, Jan.
Well,
intimately.
So because I'm a psychologist, and we all know that we go into the field because we ourselves suffer from the conditions we treat. But since we have to wrap it up, The short answer is men drive us mad. Yeah. Patriarchy drives us mad.
I understand, and vice versa. I'm going to thank everybody and then conclude the show. Special thanks today to Jan Hocken, Diane Garris Gardner, Joe Clement, Anna Coote, and Bob Peterson of Rethinking Schools. This is KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, live streamed to the universe. Wherever you are out there, KBOO is independent, supported by our listeners, beholden to no one else, but for, of course, all of humanity. All things considered, we're as thoughtful and inspiring in our public affairs and our music and our theater and our democratic governance as any radio on this planet. We deserve your support. We need it. We urge you to go to the website, become a member. Become a member or make a contribution. Just go to the tip jar upper right on our homepage. Finally, you can hear this show or any part of it again or any of our previous shows or recommend it to your friends. Go to KBOO 90.7 FM, Old Mole Variety Hour. Today's show should be up later, sometime tomorrow perhaps, maybe even this afternoon. Join us again next week for more news, views, reviews, and interviews from the Mole's Underground Perspective. I'm Bill Resnick. Joe Clement was our engineer. Thanks a lot.
good morning. It is Monday, March 24th, and it's almost a minute past 10 a.m. Coming up this morning on KBOO, it's Air Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, stay tuned for Locus Focus with host Barbara Bernstein. She will be speaking with writer Michelle Nyehouse, author of the article, Can Coal Ever Be Clean? And at 11, Grace Eagle Reed hosts Disability Awareness, a monthly show about issues affecting people with disabilities and their communities. At 10:30, Roberta Hall hosts Health and Healthcare Forum. And we also want to thank all our KBOO members for your generous support. If you're not a KBOO member, become one. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today.
Can you hear me? Good morning, Cascadia. You already know the theme for the program, so you can hum it along today. Instead, we will go virtual. Today is Monday, March 24th, 2014. And you are, of course, listening to your community radio, KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web, reaching all the way around the world. And believe me when I say we have members in far-flung places. If you do not live in a far-flung place, all the more reason to make this your community by donating to KBOO right now. Go to the website and click on that button. First, some headlines. We are going to be trying to speak with Gareth Porter today. He has a book out called Manufactured Crisis, which details right from the get-go how the U.S. meddling in a part of the world that it has proven time and again that it knows virtually nothing about. It's impossible to come up with a plan for diplomatic actions if you have no concept of the geopolitics of the region. This was previously known as the Great Game. Russia, Britain, and France in this part of the world were playing a game of power chess across Iranian territory. The Iranian territory being, in fact, ancient Persia, one of the great civilizations that the Earth has known, and wading into that situation with nothing but machinery of war has proven disastrous time and again. But we do have other headlines from closer to home. 8 people now confirmed dead in the mudslide in the town north of Seattle. And yesterday, President Jose Mojica of Uruguay announced to the Uruguayan press that he would accept a request from President Obama to receive 5 inmates from Guantanamo Bay. Funny, isn't it, that Uruguay, not considered a major power in world politics, would be the nation that stepped forward to do the right thing in the case of these people. Why they cannot be repatriated again is a matter of great shame for the world community. And 16-year-old moving slowly north from South America, 16-year-old Jose Antonio Elena, a name that is become headline news mainly around the southern border states. Elena got the kind of punishment that those who toss rocks at border patrol agents receive with startling frequency. Isn't it ironic too that throwing rocks along the wall, throwing rocks at the Israeli Defense Forces, young guys like in that age range, 16 years old, when there are the peaceful, and I emphasize peaceful demonstrations, usually on Fridays, at these walls, throwing rocks can earn you a bullet to the head, and again with startling frequency. In any case, closer to home, here on our own borders, Elena was shot with a 40 caliber round from an aged service weapon, but wait again, maybe Jose Antonio Elena didn't toss any rocks at all. He may have just been walking on a sidewalk on Mexican soil, an innocent passerby. Video of the shooting seems to be evidence that would belie the mainstream media's treatment of this story. That is beginning to come out now, despite the best efforts of mainstream media to suppress it. And sometimes you go to war with the enemy you have, not the enemy you wish you had, as Donald Rumsfeld might have put it. In a manufactured crisis, investigative journalist Gareth Porter details the manipulation and fabrications that have accompanied the current Iranian nuclear situation. The main difference between this and the Iraq war conspiracy was that the neoconservatives who were carrying it out never got the war on Iran that they were after. And still to this day is in Israel, the cry is for war with Iran, and very likely behind the scenes something is brewing. Funny that we're listening into Angela Merkel's emails and communications. Well, the U.S. doesn't spend very much time on places like Crimea, or for that matter, Israel, where you would think the Israelis would come out and tell them what's going on. In any case, we have Gareth Porter on the line right now. Good morning, Gareth. Thank you so much for being with us today at such short notice.
Thank you.
This is a really important book. This is an extraordinary book, Manufactured Crisis. It details everything from the get-go. Can you talk a little bit? You recently did a terrific